It is 8:29, and you are listening to Mind Over Matters here on KEXP 90.3 FM Seattle. And I sit across the table from Maria Tomchik and John Parrish, both co-editors from Eat the State.
You know, we never mention that there's actually another co-editor as well.
Well, you do, but not very often.
Yeah, and let's face it, he never gets up this early on a Saturday morning anyway, so, you know, it's his loss. But yes, Troy Skills does a very wonderful job as well when he's not in Mexico.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Most of the time he's preparing to go back to Mexico. But.
Yes, and he actually writes from Mexico, mm-hmm. too, but anyway.
And does a very good job.
But yes, hello, good morning.
Good morning, how are you both?
I'm splendid. I was off in New Mexico last week, among other things.
You were visiting Roswell, I understand.
Yeah. I got this mysterious phone call at 3 in the morning, and, well, you know, you want to follow up on tips like that. but anyway.
All right. Well, speaking of Roswell and things from outer space, you would think
oh, we're on the Bush administration again, are we?
Yes. Wednesday was a day when the current administration was doing the hard sell and the UN was saying, we don't buy it.
Yeah, no, Wednesday, a lot of things were happening. While the U.S. press was focusing on Bush signing the congressional resolution to authorize him war powers to start a war against Iraq, at the same time, the UN was having a very unusual open discussion on the same topic on whether or not to go to war with Iraq. And what do you know? Almost every single country in the UN stood up and said, no, inspections first, we don't want a war with Iraq. So, and that was amazing. It was country after country.
170 of them. It was amazing.
Yeah. Country after country got up and argued against a military option, which left the U.S. virtually isolated. And, of course, this incident went virtually unreported in the U.S. And what was very interesting was the very next day, on Thursday, the State Department announces that it's trying to rewrite the draft resolution before the U.N. Now, what they want to change, and this is interesting, I had to look at several different news sources to find out exactly what they were going to change in the resolution. Turns out they're going to try to remove the threat of military force from that resolution. They're going to try to remove the use of troops to accompany the inspection teams. They want to remove the clause that would have allowed any representatives from any of the five veto-wielding members of the Security Council to join the inspection teams in Iraq at any time, which means that what would be left over is simply a strongly worded resolution calling for Iraq to allow the inspectors in.
Which they've already agreed to do.
Mm-hmm. Which has already, you know, been agreed to by all the other members of the UN Security Council. It's what it basically does is it's the U.S. stepping way back from its belligerent position and accepting the French position that first let's call for Iraq to let the inspectors in, and then later, if they don't comply, we'll sit down and talk about another resolution, maybe authorizing force.
Yeah, and the following day, you had Colin Powell coming out and saying, well, the UN doesn't matter anyway. If we decide we're going to invade, we're going to invade.
Yeah.
And it's very hard to tell whether that, particularly coming from Powell, is more of the White House's belligerence and saying, well, yeah, you know, go back and forth with the UN, but at the end of the day, we're going to do what we can do and the rest of the world can jump on the lake. Which I think is a position some of the hawks in the Bush administration are very near and dear to, especially the ones who think the UN is a communist conspiracy anyway, or whether it's simply a bit of face saving to sort of paper over the fact that they're getting their head handed to them, not just by the rest of the world, but you look at opinion poll after opinion poll of the American public, and it's moving in the direction of no war in terms of the flat should we invade Iraq or actually launch an unprovoked attack upon Iraq question. But if you look at the stipulations, and there are two major ones, should we invade Iraq if we do not have the support of the members of the international community being one, and then should we invade Iraq if there's the UN question, and then should what's the other
should
one?
Should we invade Iraq if if we go it alone and don't have a coalition.
Yes, that. Thank you. I was having a morning brain lock there, and you know, both of those things are sort of like, should we invade Iraq if pigs fly? I mean, you know, we're not going to invade Iraq with the support of the international community unless Saddam Hussein does something really, really stupid, which, you know, he's certainly capable of doing, but that certainly can't be expected. And you know, when you look at those numbers, should we invade Iraq if there will be large numbers of U.S. casualties, yeah, is the mm-hmm. other one. And then, you know, if you look at those numbers, it's very, very clear that if there's any risk at all that the United States gets bogged down there, and that's not a question of whether the military can flatten Baghdad and then march in. Nobody doubts that we have the technical capacity to do that. But the streets of Baghdad, like the streets of every other major city in the Islamic world, are going to simply erupt, and they're going to keep erupting and erupting and erupting. And that's the major security issue that a U.S. invasion of Iraq would provoke. Once you start, and you know, we saw that, we may have already begun to see that with recent attacks in Kuwait and the Gulf states and in Indonesia. Once you start factoring that in, I think the Bush administration is making some calculations that the political cost of this may in fact be very high, and that in fact the flood of emails and calls and street protests in the last few weeks have had an impact.
I think there's another aspect to this too. There's a couple things I want to say. One is that I think there was a sudden change, this pullback on the UN resolution here, with the U.S. rewriting the resolution, for a couple of reasons. One is that we lost a key ally who stood up in the UN and said, no, there shouldn't be any use of force unless it is backed by the UN. And that key ally was Kuwait. We had been counting on Kuwait to allow us the use of its bases over
and
there.
And the moral legitimacy also, since they're the ostensible victim that started
all this. Mm-hmm. They basically stood up, and the quote was, any use of force must be a last resort and within the United Nations framework. That's, I believe, the first time that Kuwait has actually said that outright. I think another reason, now you can argue with this, you can say, well, there were other reasons, you know, the Bush administration was busy with the visit with Ariel Sharon. You know, they've been tied up with an upcoming visit.
And wasn't
with,
that ironic?
Yeah, they were tied up with an upcoming visit, planning for the visit of Jiang Zemin, the Chinese premier. You know, there are congressional hearings going on about what was known prior to 9/11. You know, there's still a massive fundraising and campaigning going on for November elections. And so it was okay. It was easy for Colin Powell to get his way on this.
Yeah.
But
and the economy's collapsing also.
Right, right. But you could say also too, Colin Powell's announcement that we reserve the right to go to war with Iraq in spite of, you know, if the UN decides not to do anything, was a sort of a handout or sort of a face saving gesture for Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz and all of those folks at the Pentagon,
maybe
the hawks.
Yeah.
You know, you could say that's true. But I think my favorite view of this is that there's a split at the Pentagon over this war in Iraq, and that split is hemorrhaging leaks nearly every day now that are embarrassing to the White House. I mean, last week we saw wild rumors that Rumsfeld is an abusive hothead and doesn't listen to what any of his advisors are telling him.
Rumors?
We saw leaks of the U.S. having done, or the release of documents by the Pentagon that the U.S. itself has done experiments with chemical and biological weapons on its troops and on its own citizens. As well as citizens of Canada and Britain. We've seen other leaks in the past weeks as well. And this week we saw, or last week we also saw CIA insiders complaining that they can't do their jobs because Donald Rumsfeld and Paul Wolfowitz keep going back to them and telling them to skew the data on Iraq so that we can go to war with them. So, I mean, there are all these leaks going on that I think indicate that there's a real split at the CIA and the Pentagon over this war against Iraq. This week's leak, my favorite, is the leak from the State Department that North Korea has a nuclear weapons program. Gosh, you know, Iraq is not alone. In fact, North Korea has it too, and North Korea's program is more developed than Iraq's could ever be. In fact, North Korea has been able to obtain equipment for its uranium enrichment program and has admitted that it has such a program going. North Korea has the technology and may have a plutonium bomb. North Korea also got its nuclear material from, guess who? Pakistan. Now, in order to kind of soften this, some officials have said, well, Pakistan and possibly Russia and China too. But you have to understand that Russia and China are the big dragons in that part of the world. They don't want competition from North Korea, and to see North Korea get nuclear weapons would be detrimental to China and Russia's political positions in that part of the world. So I'd say it's much more likely that, yeah, North Korea did exchange its missile technology with Pakistan in order to get Pakistan's nuclear technology. I think folks will remember last week how we talked about Pakistan being much more of a candidate for Iraq's position with the U.S. than Iraq is, because of Pakistan's arming and training terrorist groups and having nuclear weapons, et cetera.
Yeah, several things on that. Number one, I mean, Rumsfeld has been legendary. I mean, not just for being, you know, volcanic and short-tempered and imperial and what so forth, but also for the thing that hates him, almost that frosts him and George Bush also more than just about anything else, is leaks.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like, you know, twisting the knife that this is the big problem at the Pentagon and at various other security agencies right now.
And, you know, the State Department kept this whole announcement, this whole knowledge secret for 13 days. They learned on October 3rd or 4th, it's not clear which day, that North Korea had this nuclear weapons program, and they kept a lid on it that long until some folks, anonymous sources at the State Department, who knows who, but people who are probably disgusted with the Bush administration's push for war.
And pretty high up.
Yeah. Leaked this information to the press. And when early press articles started coming out from the AP and Reuters, there was no way the Bush administration could keep it under wraps anymore, and they finally announced it officially. Yeah.
Now, we've known for a long time that North Korea had nukes. That's the whole rationale for Star Wars, for one thing.
And why they're on the evil axis list.
Exactly. And, you know, there was yet another rigged Star Wars test over the Pacific on Monday this past week. Three in a row that have actually succeeded, you know, by skewing the test so that, you know, you drop it from a great height, and if it hits the ground, it's successful. But there was also, if people remember, the priceless quote from George Bush when he was in South Korea last spring, talking about how, you know, North Korea was a member of the evil of Axis, because any country that you know, spends so much money on the military while it has you know, children that were hungry and malnourished at home, you know, it was evil. And, you know, here we are.
Yeah, meanwhile, we have a count of homeless people in the city.
Yeah, and we also had
18% this year.
We also had the announcement that just came out yesterday that the poverty level in the United States increased, from the Census Bureau, saying that the poverty level among children and the general population was increasing again last year. But back to the Bush administration, it's not just people secretly, you know, calling up reporters in the middle of the night. It's people that are very public. Also, Anthony Zinni, who is, folks may recognize the name, he's a general who was the special envoy who was trying to negotiate and is still trying to negotiate a peace between Israel and Pakistan, or at least trying to get them to the same table or, you know, in the same time zone. He has been on record for a while, for a couple of months, as expressing doubts about invasion of Iraq. But he came out earlier this week with a very, very forceful statement. There's a good article that contains part of his quotes from a Q&A session, I believe, at the National Press Club on Saan.com. And I think Alternet also picked it up, and it's in a couple other places. But he came out very strongly saying, you know, I mean, people in the Bush administration who thinks this would be a walk in the park and that the streets in the Islamic world don't matter, you know, they don't travel the same planet that I do. And, I mean, it's a direct quote. I mean, he was very, very critical about the prospect of an invasion without UN support, of the military focus for it, and critical of the whole preemptive doctrine of saying, you know, a war is going to be used as a first resort by countries who have not attacked us. That's somebody who is a very high-profile person within the Bush administration. I mean, this is you know, not some weak-kneed pacifist liberal. He's a lifetime general, former command of the U.S. Special Forces in the Middle East, knows that part of the world better than anybody else in the Bush administration, hands down. And for him to come out publicly and be very critical of the Bush administration had to raise a lot of eyebrows on Capitol Hill, even if it didn't get a whole lot of media coverage. All of these things are not getting a lot of media coverage because, as Counterspin mentioned in the last half hour, the whole debate seems to be, well, should we invade them now or next month? Without raising these much more fundamental questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to bring up something from that you mentioned with General Anthony Zinni. There's been a lot of embarrassments in the war on terror, and in this past week we saw all of these terrorist attacks around the world, shootings at U.S. soldiers in Kuwait, the bombing in Bali, additional bombings in the Philippines, an announcement that the French tanker that exploded in near Kuwait was hit by a kamikaze small boat. There's been some interesting information coming out in the past 2 or 3 weeks. Maybe folks will remember a few months ago that there were joint U.S. military exercises, that there were two teams involved in the exercise, the red team, which was supposed to be the enemy, and the blue team, which were supposed to represent the U.S. military forces. And the scenario for the exercise was an invasion of Iraq.
Yeah, and an invasion of an unnamed dictatorial Middle East oil country.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Which means they were rehearsing for an invasion of Iraq. And what happened during those exercises, maybe folks will remember, this had its, 5 seconds of fame and then disappeared off the radar screen, was that the red team, the enemy team, won the exercise, and the U.S. military was defeated almost before the exercise had begun.
Yeah, the commander, in fact, of the red team was told halfway through the exercise, when it was clear that blue was having their tails handed to them, consistently and overwhelmingly, he was told that he had to radio in, all of his troops' positions to let the blue team know exactly where they were at all times and what they planned to do.
And then even when that didn't help the blue team, he was told then that all of his radio communications were completely cut off, so he could not communicate with his teams. But interestingly
and
enough,
and then the Pentagon told us that the blue team won.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, he was interviewed. He's been doing interviews. He's a retired colonel. He's been doing interviews on this topic in the last 2 or 3 weeks, and it's become clear how he won this exercise. Basically, he managed to sink the whole U.S. naval fleet. How did he do this? What he did was he armed lots of little kamikaze speedboats, fishing boats, etc., with explosives, and he had those little boats zooming around and ramming into the U.S. naval fleet, similar to how this French ship was damaged and similar to how the USS Cole was attacked in Yemen some years back, if people will remember that.
Yes, which was an al-Qaeda attack.
Mm-hmm. And what this did was it ended the war even before it had begun. And you can ask, well, why just sinking U.S. naval boats? Why would that end the war? Well, it's because most of the ships that he destroyed were aircraft carriers. And why were there so many aircraft carriers? Because the U.S. does not have a strong ally in the Middle East with a large Air Force base. And so the U.S. would have to use a lot of aircraft carriers to do those enormous bombing raids that are key for any U.S. attack these days. Saudi Arabia, now Kuwait, Yemen, Egypt, Jordan, Turkey, none of them will allow us to use their bases. And so the U.S., in order to invade Iraq, has to rely on using these enormous aircraft carriers. And this guy was like, okay, you're going to send me aircraft carriers? I'm going to destroy them, and I'm going to use the same simple way that the USS Cole was destroyed. That's how he won the exercise. Now, after they told him, well, you can't communicate by radio with your forces anymore, you know what he did? He said, well, I'll do what al-Qaeda does. I'll use a coded signal. We'll use the muezzins. They go up and they do the call for the evening prayer, and they send coded messages that way. And he was still winning, and so finally they said, look. they hamstrung him even further. They said, you can't do that anymore. And that's when the blue team won. And so here we have this highly, highly rigged exercise. There have got to be people in the Pentagon looking at that and just pooping their pants.
Sweating bullets,
saying, we can't do this because it would be so easy to lose.
Yeah, right. and that even makes the attack upon the French tanker last week even more significant, because that very well could have been a trial run. You know, it doesn't have to be Saddam Hussein who's going to be targeting U.S. forces.
Not at all.
If they in fact, it's probably most likely not to be. Iraq doesn't have very many boats right now. Mm-hmm. But when you're living in a part when you're operating in a part of the world where you've got Islamic countries for 1,000 miles in every direction.
I just want to say, Iraq does have a lot of small boats.
Yeah.
There are a lot of fishing boats.
Oh, fishing boats.
Operate.
Okay.
No, that's exactly the kind of boat that would work the best in this, because it's camouflaged. It doesn't look like a military boat.
Right.
Until it rams you.
Right.
You don't know it's a military boat.
Yeah, that
makes
a lot of sense.
Little speed boats, little fishing boats, that's exactly the kind of boat that struck the USS Cole and the kind of boat that struck this French tanker, something that doesn't look at all like a military vehicle.
So, and then the end of the week, they were wrapping up their 9/11 hearings, examination of what went wrong before 9/11. And one of the things that did get major news play was George Tenet coming out, head of the CIA, saying, look, we're no better off than we were, days before 9/11. If anything, it's worse, and we should be expecting something here soon. And
that I think, was a response to the massive bombing in Bali, which is, I think, very similar to other car bombings that have happened in the past. But and notably, I thought it was interesting reading reports on the bombing in Bali that they mentioned all these foreign tourists who were killed. I mean, there were something like 30 to 40 Brits who mm-hmm. died in that explosion. And the U.S. State Department said, two Americans. But those two Americans have not been identified among the dead. They're just two people who are missing in Indonesia. They're not in Bali. They're not people that have been identified yet. So it's not as if Americans in particular were targeted. In fact, many more Australians, Brits, Germans, people from Europe in particular who were targeted. And this bombing in Bali, it has raised some issues here at home, but in particular, it has really polarized people in Europe. Now, we've seen that Europe is against an attack. They're against the war on Iraq. But in particular in Britain, people are using this as an excuse to really push Tony Blair to say, don't attack Iraq, because it's not going to make any difference. In fact, it's making things worse.
Yeah. One of the things that has gotten very little play here is that much of the rest of the Western world and the site in Bali that was bombed was a well-known hangout for Australian tourists. Mm-hmm. One of the things that has really terrified the rest of the Western world about 9/11 is they feel like it could have been London or Paris or Tokyo or Sydney just as easily as New York. Now, obviously the United States is a special target for a number of reasons, but it really is a scenario for a world war in a lot of ways, where it's not just Americans or American facilities, but really any Western facilities in a part of the world that has a long history of British colonialism, a long history of all of these other countries having their transnational corporations and their backing of the IMF and their arms sales, contributing to the poverty and the oppression as well, and they see George Bush as dragging them into a war in which they are going to be targets as well, and they don't want any part of it.
Mm-hmm. One final note, I found it amusing that this week that so much of our foreign policy, of course, is focusing on these countries that supposedly have weapons of mass destruction. And meanwhile, there was a nice article about the USS Pennsylvania coming to Bangor, one of the largest delivery systems of weapons of mass destruction, and we should all be clapping because, welcome, yes. Welcome the boys home.
Oh, and we should also mention, speaking of Kitsap County and Bangor and Ground Zero, that one of the members of the Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action, Jackie Hudson, who is a retired nun who lives over there, she was involved about, I guess, a week and a half ago, but I wasn't here last week, in a Plowshares direct action in Colorado against a space-based weapon system in Greeley, and she's now in jail in Denver, and folks should send their thoughts and prayers her way and her thanks for her and another sister who were involved in that action and maybe facing quite a bit of federal jail time for that. Very, very interesting that got, as far as I could tell, virtually no, if not no, media coverage locally at all, even though a local woman was involved in that.
Yeah. You can find out more about the Ground Zero Center at their website, which I believe is gzcenter.org.
Yes, that's correct.
I don't have their phone number in front of me. So real quick, we only got about 5 minutes left. A couple local things. You wanted to mention, Jav, about Olszewski.
Where to start? Where to start? I mean, you could start with the gaping hole in the school budget, which I've been hearing rumors about for some time, and some names attached to it. Didn't really have time to track it down, and the school district finally just had to fess up. And I think a lot of other people had heard those rumors as well. But it seems that the folks in charge of telling our children how to count cannot count themselves. This came out about a week before they started moving into their big new what is being informally called by a number of the staff people the Glass Palace, their new headquarters building down south of downtown, south of the stadium area, in an area where it's much more difficult for people to get to by mass transit, and there's not as much parking available and so forth for the public. But you know, they're much nicer offices. So you've got those going on. I had a column in the weekly about three or four weeks ago, and I'm going to do another follow up one this week. But the one 3 or 4 weeks ago really criticized the school district and the school board, the folks downtown, not the principals and the teachers out on the front lines, the folks who deal day to day with the kids, because many of those people, I mean, you know, there's some incompetence, but by and large, they're heroic people who don't get paid enough and who don't have nearly the resources they need to do their work. But the folks downtown have this real hostility toward the public, and you see it in the school board meetings, you see it in their day-to-day operations, and I just got all kinds of calls from parents and teachers talking about things like bullying, you know, just all of these different simple issues, school selection, where the school district is just, you know, really being hostile and unaccountable toward the public, and it raises the question with the budget issues, with the staffing issues, the turnover, all of these things, why Joseph Olszewski is not on the hot seat, and should he be on the hot seat? And I think he should be. I think his reign over the past 3 years since taking over for John Stanford, who I was also not especially fond of, but you know, Olszewski is by most accounts a very nice man, a very well-meaning man. He's also a former CFO who's basically a financial guy
who should know how to look at the finances.
Yeah, that raises a double question, but it raises the question of you know, should he be canned? And I think he should be.
Well, yeah, and especially when he and his assistants say, oh, we never looked at the finances. What do you mean you never looked at them? What do you mean you never looked at them?
Yeah, and the board didn't either. and isn't that's amazing.
That's not amazing. What exactly are they being paid for?
Yeah, that's not amazing. I mean, that's just not doing your job.
Yeah, and not only that, but they're getting more money. I mean, they get very, very good salaries. And if you go to a school board meeting, you know, the first 15 minutes of any school board meeting is everybody telling everybody else how wonderful they are and what good jobs they do. So there's not that much accountability and a real love in there.
Okay, real quickly, events that are coming up this week.
Got a couple. On Tuesday evening, the October 22nd Coalition, which for several years has been doing police brutality and police abuse rallies on October 22nd each year. That comes on a Tuesday this year, Tuesday evening, and that starts at 4:30 at Seattle Central, and I believe they're marching downtown this year.
And for those folks who work on a Tuesday like I do until 5, you can still head down there. I think the rally starts at 4:30, and as you know, these rallies tend to go for a while.
Yeah, they're not the most timely of folks. So.
No, and so if you still want to join the march, you can. After work, if you can
get
down
so.
There.
Mm-hmm. And then for folks who have some free time today, in a couple hours, I'll be doing a panel at BookFest on Writing the Revolution, which should be interesting, especially since it'll be moderated by Jim Vesely, who's the op-ed page editor at Seattle Times. So the woman from who started Bitch and myself and a couple others will be sparring with him, I'm sure. And then right after that, Daniel Ellsberg is going to be doing a session. And there are several other very good political figures who will be at BookFest this weekend out at Magnuson Park at Sandpoint.
It's definitely worth checking out BookFest. It's moved out to Magnuson Park, and they're kind of looking at it as a trial place. I think there's better parking out there. It's probably really nice out there near the water. I think folks should go check it out.
Yep.
And the other thing that's happening on Tuesday is the city council hearing on the Mayor Greg Nichols trying to eliminate the three Seattle commissions, which we covered at the 7:30 hour this morning. So that's happening at 2 o'clock. in city council chambers. So.
And that's not unrelated, because the Human Rights Commission in particular has been very, very critical of police abuses and police shootings in Seattle. And one of the things that will happen if they combine the commissions is that they'll remove all of the people who are on the current commissions.
Right. Mm-hmm. So you can start there and then head up to Seattle Central after that. So with that, we are unfortunately out of time. Talking once again with Joff Parrish and Maria Tomchik, who are both co-editors at Eat the State. And one of you, tell us, where do we find Eat the State?
You can find Eat the State around town, in cafes, bookstores, coffee shops, bars, restaurants, wherever you can find free publications. It's often there. You can also find us on the web at www.eatthestate.org, all one word, eatthestate.org. And if you have tips, questions, comments, you want to volunteer to help us distribute or write for us, you can call our message line at 903-9461.
And one quick thing is that the issue that's coming out on Wednesday, and will also be up on the website probably a day or two after that, we'll have our election picks and endorsements and information for the upcoming election. So
and
if
we'll be talking about those in the next couple weeks.
Yeah, but especially if you're putting in an absentee ballot, even before you have a chance to hear this program, you can see some of what we have to say about that.
Very good. All right, so we'll talk to you both next week.
Sounds great.
Yep.